Welcome to New Human Living Radio Show, bringing you powerful interviews to awaken the power in you. Learn more at newhumanliving.com. And now your host, Les Jensen.
Okay, real quick, just by show of hands, who knows everything that's going to happen for the rest of their life? Just a quick poll here. Yep. Now, I assume that was your ego responding. Would I get a different answer if I asked your soul? If I asked your soul, okay, soul of said listener, is said listener fully realized, fully aware of the narratives you have in mind? That you have in mind for your human, your avatar. I mean, because, I'm no sproctologist, but our egos are a linear thinker, and our souls are much more a multidimensional, nonlinear kind of thing. And how to build a bridge, so to speak, I would suggest the soul doesn't need any training per se. It's more of bringing your ego around to be more receptive of what your soul might have in mind for this lifetime of yours. I know my lifetime has been unraveling in ways there's no way I could have comprehended. So we're gonna get into it tonight. I'm excited for our guest. The topic tonight is sacred psychiatry, and our guest tonight is Judy Seffer. We're going to bring her on in just a minute. But in part of her story, I see an unraveling of her life. She's written a book, Sacred Psychiatry, Bridging the Personal and Transpersonal to Transform Health and Consciousness. I would suggest going back to that initial question, I would suggest there's not a fast and rigid answer, like the rest of your life is on some kind of railroad tracks and there's no turn signals and no lane changing. That doesn't seem like a soul. It doesn't seem like consciousness, and it doesn't seem like love. Consciousness and love seems to always want to explore new opportunities, new outcomes. I think time's going to fly by, and so let's get to it. Again, the topic tonight is sacred psychiatry, bridging the personal and transpersonal to transform health and consciousness. For far too many, their experience with conventional psychiatry likely consisted of suppressed symptoms with pharmaceuticals, all without being considered as a whole person. It's probable that there's little exploration of the power of the sacred to promote healing, which is especially crucial in our current climate of widespread fear and disconnection. The reader is introduced to a diverse range of holistic approaches to psychiatric healing. It offers invaluable guidance on how to develop personal spiritual practice and highlights the profound significance of fulfilling the soul's purpose. There's that soul purpose again. Moreover, it illustrates the usefulness of astrology, emphasizing how toxic relationships undermine healing, showcases the remarkable healing power of food as medicine, and provides a holistic framework for weaning off psychiatric pharmaceuticals. Our guest tonight, Dr. Seffer, is a holistic healer with a private psychiatric and psychoanalysis practice in Newton, Massachusetts. She is a board-certified adult and child psychiatrist and psychoanalysis, and is on the faculties of Harvard Medical School and the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, and teaches and supervises at the Cambridge Health Alliance. Although thoroughly trained in the conventional allopathic approach to psychiatric care, she no longer endorses it and in fact believes that it causes harm. The multimodal approach she makes use with her patients, integrating her conventional training in adult and child psychiatry and psychoanalysis with functional medicine and Eastern medicine. Join me in welcoming Judy to the show. Judy, it's so nice to have you on the show.
Thank you, Les, for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, we were talking a little bit, and as I looked at your book, it seems like the evolution of your life path has taken some turns along the way. And can you give us like the 10,000-foot view of like the modalities of your practices when you first entered your profession, and then how those evolved up to where you are today?
Yes, I'd be glad to do that. I mean, for more than two decades, I practiced as a fairly conventional psychoanalyst and psychotherapist. I did sometimes prescribe medications, psychiatric medications to my patients, but I wasn't functioning as most psychiatrists do, which are, you know, they're psychopharmacologists primarily. I was very much a talking doctor first. And then when I was 49 years old, both my parents died within a few months of each other. That was in 2005. And then my marriage also ended at the same time. And I had three young children, and I was just really kind of at a loss. It was like so many losses at one time. And it prompted me to consult with an astrologer for the first time to try to make sense of what was going on. And that was the beginning for me of things changing. I went back to see her multiple times to talk about all the important people in my life. I was so fascinated and intrigued by how she could know so much about me and have so much understanding and insight with just having my birth date and birth time and birthplace, that I eventually decided that I wanted to learn to do this too. And so I apprenticed myself to a very well-known astrologer named Stephen Forrest, and then went on to have a second astrology teacher, another wonderful astrologer, Maurice Fernandez. And that's sort of the gateway. And it began a process of me exploring all sorts of different modalities you read in the introduction, like functional medicine and shamanism and energy healing and Eastern medicine. So I just explored many different avenues and started, as I would explore a new one, I would incorporate that into my practice. And so eventually my practice is as it is today, which is very eclectic. And I still do psychoanalysis and psychotherapy with patients, but I also do many other things, like treating complex chronic medical illness that presents psychiatrically and helping patients wean from medication. And I have many more conversations with patients about their spiritual life than I ever did when I was practicing as a conventional psychoanalyst.
Nice. Well, you pointed out several modalities, but astrology seemed to be a key pivot point, perhaps, of your experience.
Absolutely.
How did that impulse? I mean, if you're a, I don't know, tried and true psychiatrist, or how did astrology even find its way into your thinking enough to take action on it?
Well, that's a great question. My dad was also a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, and he was also very interested in astrology. And so I grew up with kind of astrology in the atmosphere in my home. My father had these, you know, magazines that existed at that time, Dell Horoscope. But he was in the closet about it. He was very fearful for his reputation. But the way he thought about astrology is different than how I think about it. Like, he had a very kind of old-fashioned view of things, something more predictive than what I ascribe to, and something, he would become kind of ominous around eclipses and this sort of thing, which is not the way that I think about it. But I was familiar with it, and I don't know if it was his death that prompted me to, you know, seek an astrologer, in some kind of way connecting with him and what he loved. But it definitely was not unfamiliar to me. And, you know, there was just so many, like, powerful losses going on simultaneously that it just seemed that, you know, there must be something going on in the heavens.
Do you think having your those three events in such a short period of time stressed your psyche to try to understand so much change, and that might have opened you up to a broader range of input? Because it, from my perspective, it seems like as soon as you dipped your toe metaphorically in it, there was a catalytic reaction within your psyche.
Totally. You know, like, it wasn't, it just sort of was like a gateway or some kind of, you're really right. You know, like, I was just then kind of insatiable in terms of wanting to learn about so many different things. And I think when you see the way that astrology works and you don't understand how it works, it doesn't make rational sense, that it kind of, in a way, opens you up to the possibility that there are many other things that don't make rational sense that also are real, and that work. And I just became much more open and much more curious and much more hungry for, you know, learning about things that, you know, were not just about the personality self and about, you know, childhood trauma and the environment and its effect upon, you know, the ego. You know, I became much more interested in questions about the soul and the spirit.
Nice. Well, I remember, the way I was raised was a strict Christian household, and all this would have been woo-woo, don't look at it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I had an opportunity to have an astrology reading from this astrologer from India. And mm-hmm. he was touring the U.S., and so I sign up and I go see him, and I give him my birth date and time and location, and he pulls out this little book, like a coupon book or something, and it's got all these tables in it. And he takes my birth date and time, and he looks up all these tables, he makes all these notes, and then, perhaps similar to you, he starts hitting the nail on the head about my life.
Right.
And I'm like, well,
right, it's just like so astonishing.
You know, I'm no sproctologist, but I didn't think my life was on such a fixed course. So what I find fascinating about your story is the immersion of the psychiatric and psychoanalysis element as the starting point for you as you work with patients and the study of understanding the human psyche. So I would perhaps call that a Western academic approach. And then astrology comes into the mix. And like we've been talking, it's got these insights, even though it seems like a, you know, you can print your chart and it seems like a rather static thing, but yet it seems very relevant to how we experience our life. How would you change or perhaps merge the Western academic psychoanalysis and the metaphysical astrology if you were to combine the benefits of both?
Well, I think I do that, actually. You know, like I have so much psychological training. You know, like I'm a psychoanalyst. I just, you know, had years of in-depth study of, you know, the human personality and unconscious. And so there's lots of different kinds of astrology. And the type of astrology that I'm drawn to is called evolutionary astrology, but it's also very much like a psychological astrology. So there's like very complex portraits of different types of like psychological archetypes that go with each of the zodiac signs. So, you know, when I look at an astrology chart and I talk with a person about their chart, I really bring in all of my experience and understanding of kind of the way people are and patterns of behavior and kind of average expectable responses and unconscious responses to situations. So it, like the psychoanalytic training and the psychiatric training stand me in very good stead when I'm kind of incorporating all of these other things into it. It's just, I feel by itself, it's limited. It has limitations. But it's also an important piece.
So as you expanded your experience and learning with the metaphysical side of things, and as the introduction mentioned, folded in shamanism, energy healing, homeopathic, astrology, et cetera, I guess what I'm getting at is from the psychiatrist's perspective, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're working through the person's relationship with themselves, stigmas, fears, phobias, and whatnot they might have accumulated. I mean, and I'm probably butchering the practice, but in general, you're having this interactive dialogue to understand the mechanics of the patient. And then on the flip side of that, like say for example, energy healing, how do those two swim in the same pond?
Well, you know, like, let's say a person is feeling depressed and they're having like some kind of astrological transit that is often associated with seeing things through a glass darkly. Like I could recommend to them that they stimulate certain points on their body that are like acupressure points. And I could recommend that they apply essential oils to that point, or I could recommend that they apply a flower essence remedy to that point to amplify the psycho-spiritual benefit that that point might give them. Like in the middle of the palm, there's a point that's called pericardium 8. And like a person could take lavender oil and apply that to that point in the middle of the palm. And it's very uplifting to the spirits And it helps them feel connected to their heart and helps them feel love. And it's very antidepressant. So that's like bringing energy medicine in combination with, you know, a psychological experience they're having in the context of an astrological transit. I don't know if that answers your question.
Sure, yes. Well, it seems like I was going to say the physical body, but it's more of a multidimensional aspect of who we are as a persona. The energy healing shamanism. You're working with your client on a much bigger canvas of themselves, it seems, and as you use these multiple modalities, it has a more comprehensive opportunity to work through the shift and support the person not only from the mental perspective, but from a larger modality?
Right, that's exactly right. And I really like to come at whatever it is that they're suffering with from lots of different angles. And I also have a number of practitioners who I have like great respect for and who I've had really good results when I've referred my patients to them. So like there's an acupuncturist who I routinely refer patients to. There's a homeopath who I routinely refer patients to. There's an osteopath who I refer my patients to. And so like they're getting help from like a whole variety of angles, not just, you know, not just talking, not just nutrition, not just all the different lifestyle recommendations that I make to them, but like there are all sorts of different modalities, and that seems to be a winning formula, you know, to really approach something from different angles.
Nice. Have you seen a change as you expand the modalities that you're using? Have you seen a change in your effect your clients?
I can help patients that I couldn't help before. You know, like if somebody has complex chronic medical illness, like let's say they have chronic fatigue or they have fibromyalgia or they have, you know, these very complicated medical conditions like chronic Lyme disease or mold exposure. You know, you can talk with them till the cows come home, and that is not going to, you know, shift things for them. They need a whole, you know, different approach. You know, but talking is also part of it, but not the only thing.
Nice. Well, I like that because it, I mean, through your intuition, I mean, you chose to engage the astrology modality, and that gave you profound insights, which transforms you and your services. So it's very compelling how your life has unfolded. In your book, you talk about the Greek mythological figure Chiron and your personal Chironic journey and your heavenly mandate to be a Chironic psychiatrist. How has your own life experience influenced your desire to help others?
Oh, gosh, that's a really complex question. I mean, I grew up in a family where there was tremendous trauma. You know, like my parents were both Holocaust survivors. There was a great deal of mental illness in my family. And, you know, like, I mean, my role in the family was like to, you know, try to be helpful to everybody else. And I was sort of conditioned from a very early age to try to help. And, you know, I really wasn't able to help them. You know, like, first of all, I didn't know what I know now, and I was a child.
Right.
But I think the things that I know now weren't understood then.
Right.
And it's, you know, like you know, on some level, it's a big thrill to be able to be helpful to people when, you know, you couldn't do it in your own family. You had family members that were, you know, in such, you know, distress, and there was, you were just helpless in the face of it. And I'm not helpless today, you know, like I feel, you know, very empowered to be helpful. So that's a good feeling, you know. And Chiron was a mythological figure, as you said, who was like a holistic healer. You know, like he employed all kinds of different modalities in his healing work. And he was just, you know, he had so many different skills. And so I like that. I like to integrate all kinds of different approaches. And also, you know, like Chiron was wounded by one of his students, Hercules, accidentally. He shot him with an arrow dipped in the blood of a hydra, and he had a wound that wouldn't heal. And, I mean, I believe that, you know, there are certain experiences that we go through that we don't really get over. You know, like we learn to manage them better. They don't have the same charge that they did at one point, but you never, like, get over them. Like, I never, like, will get over the fact that my mother was, like, so depressed and that she lost all of her family in the Holocaust and that, you know, she tried to take her life a number of times. I'll never get over that, but I have a different relationship to it. But it's sort of like a Chironic wound, you know, like, or the fact that she was so depressed when she was pregnant with me and when I was born said I was an ugly baby. I mean, you don't get over those things. It's just you shift in your relationship to them. There was a Ram Dass, who's like a spiritual teacher, said you can become a connoisseur of your neuroses, you know, because they don't go away, you know.
Right.
But you get a handle on things. And you make use of them, like you have understanding for people who are suffering and who have, you know, all the different suffering you've been through. You see it in other people and you kind of get it, you know. It increases your compassion. It has the potential to increase your compassion.
Oh, indeed. Very much indeed. The my father was a war vet. He fought in the Pacific campaign of World War II, and HBO put out a documentary about it, and it's through the eyes of the GI. I mean, it's reenactment kind of stuff, and oh my God, his psyche was seared with horror. And he had zero opportunity to stand down for a year and a half. And so he's in this hyper accelerated fight or die, kill or die, that I cannot comprehend. He brought that into our house as an anger or a rage that nobody in the household could even, like I say, comprehend at all whatsoever. It was just that when Dad got mad, holy crap, you know, go and hide.
Yeah.
He didn't ever hit us, but the intensity of the scarring of his psyche was just and in hindsight,
and there wasn't an appreciation of PTSD the way there is today. You know, like there was not an understanding of it.
If I could relive my life over again, I'm going to cry. I, as a little child, would go up to my dad every single day and hug him and say, damn, God, you made it. You're here. You are my father. I am so blessed. Mm-hmm. And he didn't bless me with hugs and compliments. He didn't bless me with, he was a furnace, a foundry of a tempest. And that really changed who I became. And again, like you've mentioned several times, it's in the hindsight. It's looking back. So I'm curious, astrology talks about it almost seems like our soul chooses the place and time of our incarnation to pick the thread that that astrologer pulled out of the book, so to speak. But
yeah.
what about soul contracts? Where two
like
souls
this,
will say, this time you're the villain, this time I'm the victim.
I mean, I've heard of that, and, you know, like it doesn't seem far-fetched to me, you know, that's like we take, I've heard of like soul groups, and you know, kind of incarnate with like a group of souls and take on different roles. Like this time I'll be your mother, next time you'll be my husband. You know, like I've heard of that, you know, like this is all though, of course, you know, it makes sense, but it's so speculative, right? Like we don't, like how are we going to like verify this?
Well, can we sprinkle like flour on the kitchen floor and catch ourselves sleepwalking?
You know, like astrology, you know, like the fact of astrology, like you can just see it, you know, you can see what a person's birth chart is like, and you can see what their character is like, or you can see that there's something going on in the skies now, and you can see the effect upon the life. But when you talk about like soul groups and that, you know, there's different agreements, you know, like,
sure,
I guess, you know, some people do like past life regressions and they get information like that, but you know, it's, or, you know, some kind of psychic readings, and I'm not discounting it. It's just that it's not verifiable the way that astrology is, in terms of just, you know, it's in front of your eyes.
Right. Correlating between what you're seeing in the person and what the chart is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now you write about the importance of having a multidimensional sense of yourself and the important role it plays in healing. I mean, if I'm a listener to the show and I haven't considered myself as a multidimensional persona, how would you describe that?
Well, you know, like, I think if you just think of yourself as just your personality self, and that, you know, you are just kind of going through your life and having your experiences and getting older and getting sick and dying, and that there's not like really any like purpose, greater purpose of why you're here, or that you're not necessarily connected to something larger than yourself, that it can be anxiety provoking, it can be depressing. And there are ways of cultivating our own experience and having experiences that make us aware of other dimensions of our being, and particularly like of our own divinity and the divinity of other people and the divinity of the natural world. And there's like practices that one can do that feel uplifting and feel like expansive, and they just give a lot of richness and beauty to existence that it doesn't have if you're just like stuck in the 3D reality.
Can you share some of those?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. So, for instance, I always talk about this because I think it's so meaningful. There was a cultural anthropologist named Angelus Arian who went around the world, and she studied cultures and was trying to determine what are the commonalities between all of these very different cultures. What are the commonalities about their spiritual practice? And she came up with three things that were kind of common to, you know, vastly different cultures. And she called it the blessing way. And the first one was prayer. Like all over the world, people pray, you know, so it's like you're not like just trying to do your life by yourself. You're like connecting with something greater than yourself and asking for guidance and asking for assistance and asking to be shown the way And
right.
So prayer is like a big commonality. The second one was gratitude. I mean, it is so uplifting to focus upon gratitude, like to give thanks before you eat your food, to, you know, appreciate, you know, the beauty of nature and to be grateful for the flowers, to be, you know, grateful for very simple things like a shower, a warm shower or a comfortable bed. I mean, there are so many things that we can be grateful for and not take for granted. And when you do that and you focus upon these blessings and these positive things, it uplifts your spirits. And the third thing that she identified was like tangible acts of service that like increase the amount of beauty or goodness in the world or do something to uplift another person or to help another person. So like when when you try to pay attention to what you can do to contribute to the good in the world or to make the world a better place, it comes back to you a millionfold. You know, like it, you know, it's, I mean, that's not the reason to do it, but it does, you know, like.
Right.
So like those three things, I mean, I talk with patients about that all the time because a lot of times people come to see me and they have no spiritual practice, but they really would like to have one. They just don't know how to go about it. And
right.
So I'll talk with them about like, you know, creating an altar. An altar doesn't need to be a whole dedicated room. You can just take a corner of your room and you can put down a pretty cloth and you can gather some different objects that have meaning to you, that have some kind of sentimental value or remind you of a beautiful place or a trip that you made or a picture of a loved one or a basin, a beautiful flower or a bowl that you change the water every day and ask for refreshment of your soul and healing of the waters of the earth. You just make it up, you know, and it just puts you in touch with the sacred dimension of life. And then you're not just like trudging through your to-do list and, you know, being like nose to the grindstone and not like stopping and appreciating something greater than yourself.
Oh, indeed. Very well said. I would say that that's an endless journey. The more you discover
endless. And it's, I like to like mix my spiritual practice up and always like adding something new and trying something different and making it up and enjoying that.
The stint I have with organic whiskey shots kind of healed my relationship with gravity. No, I'm kidding. Well, I'd like to look at some of the points that your book makes. You mentioned ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. What does your clinical experience been with this medicine, and how does it support your patients?
Well, that's a relatively new addition to what I have to offer. I did the training a year ago in May, and I've been doing quite a bit of it. It's been so helpful, you know, like it's the only legal psychedelic, so it's the only one that I can offer to my patients. But I do it in this very sacred and ceremonial way, and like there's all kinds of different ways that ketamine can be administered. Like there's ketamine clinics where they give IVs with high doses. I do it with a lozenge, and I like that's when I conduct myself in the most shamanic way is when I'm doing the ketamine assisted psychotherapy. Like we'll, you know, invite the ancestors and spirit guides in with the drum, and we'll rattle and call in the directions, and we'll smudge, and we'll set up an altar, and they'll bring things for the altar, and I'll bring things, and we may pull an oracle card, which can kind of inform the journey. And then the person puts on an eye shade and lies down on the couch, and you have to try to figure out what's the right dosage, so because you want them to be significantly altered, but you also, I think it's most it's optimal to be able to continue to be able to talk and communicate. And like I'm scribing the whole time and writing down what they're experiencing. But, you know, it's been helpful for patients who have like chronic depression, patients who just feel like they're in a anxiety state a lot of the time, patients who have trouble with addiction, and even patients, you know, like I have one patient who is an acupuncturist, and she feels like through doing the ketamine, she did it really sort of for personal growth. She's like a high, well-functioning person, but she doesn't, she feels like she now doesn't sweat the small stuff in the same ways, and she's able to be more present with her patients and doesn't feel such a need to like fix things. So it can be used in a whole variety of ways. It can be used for people who have trauma. It's very helpful, and I think it's a great tool.
Very nice. I agree. Here in Colorado, a lot of it got legalized, psilocybin and others. And there's a how would I say this? There's a I don't want to say a push, but vets with PTSD are really looking at the microdosing of psychedelics as a healing modality. Because I'd love to have seen something like that make a difference with my dad. And
Yeah, of course. Like what? Like how amazing, right? Like
right.
If he had access to that.
Right. Well, in your book, you talk about mast cell activation syndrome, and as it's a powerful contributor to inflammation, but you talk about when there's a collage, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but a bunch of perhaps conflicting symptoms in the client. Can you expand on that?
Well, you know, like sometimes, well, let me just talk a little bit about mast cell activation because probably many of your listeners don't know what that is. The mast cells are white cells that are part of the immune system, and we have them all over our bodies. And the highest concentrations where we have them, everybody has them, is in their lungs that interfaces with the environment, the air exchange, or in the gut interfaces with, you know, food exchange, absorption. And so they have like these little sacs inside of themselves, and they're filled with these active substances like histamine and different kinds of biogenic amines. And when they're well functioning, there's some kind of intruder, some kind of pathogen, some kind of invader problem. And they come to that place and they release their substances and they kind of neutralize it and they're doing their job. But sometimes they start like degranulating in a very chaotic way and in a very hyperactive way. And then they create like excessive inflammation. And because we have them in all parts of our body, like a person who's having like sinus symptoms and they're having GI symptoms and they're having joint pain and they're having rashes. And it's like it doesn't fit a pattern that is like recognizable to a physician who's not aware of mast cell activation. So they'll say, oh, you know, this person is complaining of everything in the kitchen sink. It should, they must be just terribly stressed. They should go see a psychiatrist, you know?
Right.
So it's very invalidating for the patient because there's something terribly wrong. And they go see a psychiatrist and, okay, you know, yes, they are very anxious when the mast cells degranulate. It does make you anxious. It also makes you anxious and depressed when nobody believes you and says you're stressed. It does make you stressed. So there is a treatment for it. You know, you give supplements, and eventually you can give pharmaceuticals even if the supplements don't work, that stabilize the mast cells. That can make a huge difference in a person's symptom profile. And so it's really a very common condition, and it's a common condition that patients end up in psychiatrist's office with.
Even though it's a physical condition, right?
It's a physical condition that there's a treatment for it.
Right.
And it can occur, you know, for many, many, many different reasons. Like it can be a result of mold toxicity. It can be a result of chronic Lyme. It can be a result of long COVID, post-viral infection. It can be a result of trauma, car accident. It can be a result of a divorce. You know, like it can result from like so many different things, but it's all like mast cell activation. And, you know, like if it's due to mold toxicity, then, you know, you shouldn't stop with just treating the mast cell activation. You should also treat the mold toxicity. But it's a very important condition to recognize because it can be helped.
Well, that's fascinating. As you just described, people might end up on the metaphorical couch, and really it's more of like you're saying, mold or other perhaps trigger mechanisms or whatever the correct
yeah.
language would be. And when you said that depression might sink in because they're telling these practitioners all these different symptoms and they're not getting any acknowledgement perhaps or help coming back. And so, boy, I could really see how that would compound over time.
And it's particularly difficult when, you know, it's a parent who has a child that has it going on, and then the parent gets, you know, the suspicion directed towards the parent, like, you know, what are they doing? They're like seeking attention, seeking, like acting like there's something wrong with their kid. And because, you know, like the doctor will do, you know, blood tests and test whatever they know how to test for. And they're not, it doesn't come up because they're not testing for the right thing. And anyhow, I don't test for mast cell activation. For me, it's a clinical diagnosis. Like when I see a certain symptom picture, I recognize it. There are, you know, very specialized laboratory tests that can be done, but they have to be handled in a very specific way, and I don't think it's really worth it because they're often mishandled, the laboratory specimens, and it's expensive, and you can make the diagnosis clinically. And then you just, you know, prescribe supplements that stabilize the mast cells, and you see if it's helpful.
Nice. Well, that's got to help a lot of people that, I mean, just to be able to recognize that. Because, Ghanan,
right.
if you don't recognize that, you're on a merry-go-round.
Right. And like, I have a memory of a patient who I saw before I knew about mast cell activation. Every time she would eat, her stomach would hurt so badly. And I tried to help her with what I knew, but I didn't know the right things, and so I really couldn't help her.
Well, you've really expanded the things that you know. I mean, with all these new modalities, do you see yourself expanding more and more over time? And
yes,
it's,
I do.
Do you?
I do. I never get tired of learning new things.
Does that make you smile, or is there drudgery to it?
No, it's not drudgery, because if it's drudgery, I wouldn't do it.
No. Right.
Like I mean, like I'm right now I'm working through this program called Primal Trust, which is a brain retraining limbic system program for like creating safety in the body. And I mean, I have prescribed limbic system retraining programs to my patients for some time now, but I'm now personally working through this myself and just finding it fascinating and learning a lot. So, you know, it doesn't get boring because, you know, you just keep adding new things, and like the ketamine was a whole new toy, you know.
Right. Well, you write about helping patients to wean from psychiatric medications. How do you approach this?
Well, that is a very important expertise that I've developed, because the way that I was trained is that, okay, you know, cut it in half, then, you know, do that for like a week, then, you know, cut it in half again, do that for like a week or two, and then stop it. Well, you do that for some patients, and they have the most horrible withdrawal syndrome that really literally causes post-traumatic stress disorder. They feel so traumatized by how badly they feel when the medications are withdrawn so quickly. That can be the case with some of the antidepressants and with the benzodiazepines. And so the way that I do it is that I don't touch their medication to begin with. And if they are symptomatic, I will ask them to increase their dose and go up to the point that it was before they started having any withdrawal syndromes, because sometimes they come to me because they've tried to withdraw themselves and it's just not working. And then I want them to follow an anti-inflammatory whole foods diet. And I want them to do this, you know, limbic system brain retraining to stabilize their nervous system. And then when those two pieces are in place and they're, you know, getting outside and getting sunlight and moving their bodies, then I will begin to decrease their medications 10% a month. And if they become destabilized, we may not decrease it the following month, or we may decrease it only 5%. And you know, some of these medicines, you have to get them from a compounding pharmacy. You know, like you can't, like, let's say Zoloft comes in 100 milligrams, but it doesn't come in 90, you know, so you might have to get it compounded by the compounding pharmacy. And so I just keep reducing very slowly and very cautiously and having them be supported with, you know, proper nutrition and all the lifestyle things that I mentioned. And usually it's very successful.
Well, very nice. An hour can go by pretty fast. I want to make sure that the audience knows about you, your modality. Do you work with people in person, online, all over the world? Book, your website?
Yeah, I'd love for people to buy my book. That would be wonderful. Buy my book and read it. That's what I care about the most right now. My practice is very busy, and I'm only allowed to work with patients who live in Massachusetts unless they come and see me in my office. You know, so like a person who lives in New York could work with me, but they would have to see me in person. Like I couldn't do telehealth with somebody who doesn't live in Massachusetts. I'm going to be speaking at a conference, a keynote speaker at a conference in Sedona in mid-October, and it's about integrating spirituality into mental health, into psychotherapy. So that's kind of what I'm up to at the moment. I have a blog that's associated with my website, and you can sign up for that. I write about things that are interesting to me.
Well, very nice. Well, we live in such chaotic times, and this can take various stresses and tolls on our persona. Do you have any closing thoughts for our audience?
Yeah, and I really agree with you that we're undergoing this tremendous time of transformation and change where the old world that we knew is really dying and a new world is being born. And when we're during these times of transition like this, it creates a lot of stress, and there can be a lot of fear and a lot of chaos, and the powers that be that don't want to relinquish, you know, their power, and they don't want things to change. They want things to stay the same, which they're not going to do. They start behaving more badly than ever. And just during times like these, it's more important than ever to, like, really exercise excellent self-care and to, you know, do all the kinds of things that we've been talking about in terms of fostering resilience, because like if you have a poor diet or if you're sedentary or if you don't get outside and move your body, you're not going to feel well, and it's going to make it much harder to deal with all of these changes that are coming at all of us.
Well said. Well, I want to thank you for being our guest tonight. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation.
Me too. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Les.
We've been talking, the topic tonight is Judy's latest book, Sacred Psychiatry, Bridging the Personal and Transpersonal to Transform Health and Consciousness. What a fun conversation. It's jeepers. How do you even throw language at it? It's like I could have a bucket of paragraphs and soak them in water and throw it at a topic and hope they stick. And that topic is really you, the listener, you, the persona, you, the human being. That there's so much that we can discover about ourselves. And I suggest that it's without end, because both love and consciousness seems to always seek expansion. Just today, I was walking. I'd like, you can share your take on this if you want. So out the back door of my house, I have a shop, a big garage that I can fuddle around with the welder and everything. And it's only about 15 feet away. And today I'm walking out to the back, and about halfway there, this dragonfly flies right in front of my face, and I stop and I look around and I'm like, holy crap, it's a swarm of dragonflies. They move so flipping fast, and I tried to barcode them, but they wouldn't slow down. That was a joke. There was so many of them, I would guess maybe 8 to 10 or so. And I just stand there, and they're buzzing me. They're flying all around me. They fly right at me and take a hard left. I didn't see any proper traffic protocol amongst them. They didn't seem to mind. But I stood there for like 15 minutes, and I've never had perhaps an animal totem interaction like that, and so many of them. And I was just surprised by that. I would suggest that you think from your heart and your soul when it comes to your future. I think our egos can't really even comprehend the vision, or in other words, if I could step out of my ego and still generate sentences, if I could transport myself to my soul perspective, my soul perspective of what my life can be, and then turn around and try to convey that to my ego, I'm having a non-linear perspective, a non-linear vision from my soul consciousness, and then try to convey that in symbols and words to the linear ego mind. I guess what I'm saying is the more you can teach your ego to like stand down or stand back and create some room in your consciousness, and develop a rapport, an interaction with your heart and your soul, I'm experiencing levels of that during these days, through these past weeks. The more I try to, how do I say this, try to comprehend what my soul is showing me, my knees go weak. It's like, what the crud? Are you sure you mean, I mean, I'm a small town farm boy from Utah. Let's go milk the cows and buck hay. And you're showing me all this stuff that could be potentials for my life. Wow. Damn. You know, I don't want to miss a thing. I want to really figure out how to get my ego to walk in step with my heart and my soul. Well, hey, here we are at the end of the show, and here you are too. Kudos to you, the listener. You've showed up for yourself. I applaud you for that. I'm your host, Les Jensen. Always a pleasure. Until next time, thanks for listening.